Hey everyone, welcome back to another episode of the Scrubbed In Show. I hope you've all been keeping well. This week we're joined by Sarah Siegel, who's the Global Healthcare Lead at Deloitte, where she's been there for close to 20 years, starting off as a manager, working her way up to a partner. But what I'm most interested to know about is, I looked at your bio and I realized you studied something called Communications and Romance Languages at university. So we would love to talk about your career, all the wonderful things you're doing, you know, how you've managed to stay and progress at a big consultancy firm. But Sarah, you have to tell us, what is romance languages?
Sure. Well, this bit of the story might not be popular with the English audience, but the story goes, I went to university at Northwestern, which is a university in Chicago. And when I got there, I was enrolled in the Arts and Sciences undergraduate college. And it's a big university with an engineering department and all, you know, all different parts. And I didn't really know what I wanted to do, I think, like most 18-year-olds. And I was sort of dabbling. And I really liked the idea that I could take a calculus course and then take an economics course and then take a course in the radio, TV, film school about journalism and media. And so I was dabbling and I found they had a whole school that was dedicated to communications. Mm-hmm. And it was, you know, legal communications, theories of argumentation and debate, communications through history, you know, all kinds of cool different public speaking things. And I was like, oh, well, this is like super practical. And I sort of thought in my cloudy, you know, I was probably 19 or 20 by then, brain, like, no matter what I end up doing, this will be useful. So I will do this. So I changed to that school. I changed my major to communications. And then because I had studied French previously, and I really wanted to learn Spanish because I thought it was a really useful language, I chose romance languages as my minor and communication studies as my major. And that way I was learning the languages. And at this particular university, you also study the literature of that country. And I wanted to spend time abroad. So I was able to do that. I went and spent a term in Valencia, Spain, live with a family, which was amazing. So that is, yeah, that is the story of my undergraduate education. You will have spied that there's no medical degrees in that CV, which I'm sure we'll come to.
For sure. No, it caught me off guard. And I was like, you know, this is interesting. Would you describe yourself as a creative? And you probably understand where I'm going with this, for someone that went into kind of consulting. What is kind of your personality traits? And the reason I'm asking is, a lot of doctors, a lot of our listeners are kind of going into alternative careers, and top of that list is consulting. So keen to know what your personality was like there, and has it changed since you gone into the world of consulting?
That's so interesting, because when you say creative, I think about my family. So I have a husband and two sons, and my husband and one of my sons are really musical and they're amazing at drawing and painting. And so when you say creative, I think of them and I think of me, and then I'm like, no, that's not me. I can't do any of that stuff. But I suppose, I mean, I went into consulting because I didn't know, continuing the theme, I didn't know what I wanted to do. And I thought, okay, I'll do this job and then I'll work for lots of different companies and maybe government, and I'll just sample and then I'll figure out what I want to do. And then I'll go to my next thing once I know. So it was kind of a, just like my major, it was a stopgap choice. It definitely wasn't because I thought I was creative. But I think that what I've discovered through now many, many years of consulting is that actually it's good for my personality, because I'm someone who doesn't like too much routine. Like, I think if I went to the same office every day and performed the same tasks with exactly the same people, that I would get really bored. So I love meeting new people. I love new client challenges, or even the same client challenges in a different setting with a slightly different twist, where you've got to do a little bit of thinking work to solve it. And I like just, yeah, going new places, not being in the same place. So I think it was just that constant challenge and just always something new that kept drawing me to the role. And I suppose there is an element of creativity in it, but not the kind of creativity that immediately came to my mind when you said the word.
No. Definitely, which is very interesting. Tell us about this journey at Deloitte. You know, how did it come about? Very keen to hear the career progression and how you managed to kind of get to where you are now.
Sure. So, I mean, I think I've told you the beginning of it. I went to university. When I graduated, I thought I'll do management consulting because I didn't know what I wanted to do. I interviewed with Deloitte. They didn't offer me a job.
Jerks. Oh, no.
And it was my number one choice. I had very little to go on. I just decided that that was the firm for me, but I didn't get a job there. I was offered jobs by other firms, and I decided to take one with a firm, which then was called A.T. Kearney. They've shortened it to Kearney since then. Mm-hmm. So I went to work for them. I went to work for them in their New York office. I worked on all kinds of things. I worked at a telecommunications company. I worked at a big automotive manufacturer. Oh, wow. I worked for a French building materials company. I worked for a university, actually. I worked for a big bank. All kinds of different clients. And the questions were always in the kind of strategy and operations realm. Mm. And then I decided that even though I had gone to school and sampled so many classes at Northwestern that I needed an MBA because I hadn't taken a lot of business classes. Mm-hmm. And quickly I realized I couldn't read a balance sheet or do a valuation or some of the things that would be needed if I wanted to continue to pursue this career. And at the time I was working in Toronto, Canada. And for some reason, all of the Canadians around me had been to this business school in France called INSEAD. And they just kept saying, oh, you have to go to INSEAD. And it was only 1 year, which was quite different to a lot of MBA programs, which are 2 years. There's more 1 year programs now, but this is like 20 years ago. So. Mm. And I was like, oh, this is great. It's in France. I love France. I speak French. It's only 1 year because it's kind of an opportunity cost out of your life, right? Like you're not making money for that year and you're paying money for that year or 2 years. And when you come back, like, will you get a promotion? Will you make more money? Like, what's the math around the actual total cost of this time in your life? So for me, I just thought like, these topics don't require 2 years to learn. I can do it in a year. More fun to do it in France. So I applied to INSEAD, went there. And when I finished, A.T. Kearney had kindly agreed to pay for my tuition, but I owed them either the money, which I didn't have, or 2 years more working with them. So I went back to A.T. Kearney, but by this time I spent a year in France and I really didn't want to go back to the U.S. So I found someone in the A.T. Kearney London office who wanted to move to the New York office and we organized a swap.
Oh, wow.
So he moved to New York and I moved to London. Great guy. He's doing really well in his career. I won't call him out because I'm here. Anyway, so I moved to the London office and it was there that I did my first project with the NHS.
Nice.
This was in like the early 2000s. And there was a thing that used to be called the Purchasing and Supply Agency or NHS PASA, which was in charge of basically doing big framework agreements for anything from like loo rolls to surgical gloves to drapes and gowns. They did food. And it was basically, you know, it was optionality for trusts to purchase various supplies from. And they used to use it as kind of a floor. Then they would negotiate their own binding contracts, usually with better pricing directly with the suppliers. Anyway, I did a project with them, introduced me to the NHS. And I was like, oh, this is interesting. This is much more enjoyable as a client than, no offense to my French building supplies company, but like, you know, sheet glass. And the concept of working in was really interesting. And I was then able kind of to go on and work on projects, you know, all throughout the health system that, you know, I saw the huge value that could be added through supporting the NHS. And I got really interested. But your question was about Deloitte. So I'm still at A.T. Kearney. I'm working in their London office.
Yeah.
And I was working for two partners who then decided to move from A.T. Kearney to Deloitte. And I looked around and thought, like, what matters? Is it the firm you work for or is it the people you work with? And I thought it's the people at this moment in my career, these were great mentors, is the people you work with. So I decided to move across to Deloitte. And so I think I started at the beginning of 2005. And yeah, and here I sit. It's been amazing. It's been, as you said, and before we started recording, Abdul, really unusual to work in the same place for so long. So few of my friends have had a career like mine.
A question here, Sarah. What does it take for a company to keep someone for that long? 18 years running, 20 years coming. What is it about Deloitte that has sort of said, you know what, we love you, you love them, and you've just stayed there? What are some of the factors?
Well, I think for any of us to stay in any profession, you know, as a clinician or in a firm like Deloitte, you have to feel valued by the place that's employing you. And then for your own selfish needs, you have to feel like you're learning and growing. And like every day, you're going to have some fun. Like the whole day won't be fun, you know, for sure. But like you're going to laugh, you're going to smile, you're going to say, oh, I'm seeing that person. And you're going to think, oh, I like that person. I'm looking forward to having that meeting. You know, we spend so many hours of our life working. It has to be accretive to you, both on an enjoyment level, but also from a developmental perspective. So I think those are just really important things. And it comes down to the people you work with. I also think that what the firm's been really good at with me is recognizing what I need and giving it to me. So seeing when I get bored, giving me a new challenge, when I ask for things, not always saying yes, but like hearing me out. And if they say no, I understand why. I know what to go back with when I ask a second time, basically. So, you know, I've definitely been very, very fortunate in my career, but it definitely comes down to A, knowing what you want and asking for it, and then being lucky enough to be in a place where you get those things.
No, that's incredible. Yeah. Kind of going to present day, some of the roles you do, you have probably seen a fair bit of change, or, you know, some people might disagree there has not been change, but how has the NHS been in the last 20 years or so, the last two decades? And, you know, what are some of the biggest challenges we're still facing? And, you know, how are you, Deloitte, how are yourself kind of trying to overcome those obstacles?
Yeah, I think in many ways, it's super easy to say like, oh, it hasn't changed that much, and we still have all these problems, which in a sense is true. But the truth is, it has changed massively. And sometimes, you know, just like when you have a child and you don't notice that it's growing because you see it every day, it has changed a lot. But what I will say is, you know, with my global hat on, like the comparisons to other countries have changed a lot. I think the NHS used to be, and still is to a certain degree, held up as a wonderful health system for a lot of reasons. It still does give people amazing healthcare free at the point of need, which very few other countries can offer. We still do decently well in the life expectancy tables. There's been some, you know, chopping and changing in recent years. Mm. But we have major issues. You know, our waiting lists are terrible. I think the challenges that we've had on urgent and emergency care and ambulance response times is really scary. Mm. It's just not good enough. It's the same thing for cancer waits. So these are things that definitely need to be addressed.
No, definitely.
But it has changed a lot. And on the plus side, I think the people that come into the NHS now come in with the same approach that all of young people have today, which is, you know, I know what I think is right, and I'm going to speak about it, and I'm going to make change. We're not manufacturing sheep anymore. We're manufacturing people who seem to have a lot more like verve and speak out, which I think is a good thing for the NHS. And I think sometimes change, unfortunately, needs to be somewhat generational, but the generations, you know, they are shifting through. Hmm. But we've seen so much happen quickly as well. I mean, we had a big, big role during COVID, and some of the programs related to digital and technology that were really hard to get acceptance for pre-COVID just got snapped up like that.
Yeah.
And when I look at the proportion, and I know everyone cites these same examples, but they're true. When I look at the proportion of GP consults that happen virtually now versus before, it's wonderful. You know, my kid had like a gooky thing in his eye, and I called our GP fully prepared to take time off work and bring him in. And he just said, send me a few pictures. And is he itching? And is it like this? He's like, I'm going to prescribe you something. If it doesn't work, call me back. And I was like, brilliant.
Crazy.
No kid in school, mom at work. Awesome. You know? So definitely, you know, things are improving. But I have to say, I was at a big global hospital conference a month ago, and I was, you know, walking the halls and touring the exhibits by the different hospital groups in different countries. And some of the stuff I saw blew me away. You know, level of automation, inventory management, level of virtual wards, level of digitization. I cannot say that on these points, we are the leading health system in the world right now.
Definitely. Mm-hmm. And that was the question I wanted to come on to is, with your kind of global healthcare hat on, having the privilege to see, what countries would you say are really excelling and maybe things that the UK can learn from? And, you know, what has the reception been to kind of AI, digital transformation in those countries? Because I know sometimes there is a bit of resistance with the NHS and the healthcare in the UK.
Yeah, definitely. So it's so funny that you ask the question that way. We have a research arm called the Center for Health Solutions, which I encourage your listeners to Google. There's lots of free research reports about healthcare there and life sciences as well. And we have a wonderful woman who runs the center. And I'm always asking her to do a report, which does this, like, what is the best country? And then break it down by the pieces of the system. And she's like, there is no best country. But we've just published something called The Future of Europe, where we've said, here are countries that are great at different elements. And we've kind of chunked it out into pieces. So there is that, and I won't steal her thunder here, but I encourage your listeners to go and check that out. But there is a lesson there. You know, like, there's not one panacea. There's not one country that's doing it all wonderfully. Mm-hmm. And the countries that overall do have a stronger scorecard, you know, like Singapore, for example, they're really small. So it's a lot easier to move the needle with a small population of 2 to 5 million than it is with, depending on how you want to measure, if it's England or the whole UK, you know, 50, 60 million. You know, in fact, this is a really big cohort for the type of structure that we have around it. And I think that is part of our challenge in terms of some of the inertia that we see and some of the challenge we have in terms of uptake of innovation. Because you mentioned, for example, that there's been some pushback to new technologies and to AI. Mm-hmm. And I see that too. And I get it. And some of it is with really good reason, right? Some of this stuff is really new and untested, and we don't want to be using it in anger anyway. Mm-hmm. But some of it is because of fear and lack of understanding and lack of ownership of the process as well. We hosted a breakfast a few weeks ago with some colleagues from NHS England, and we were talking about innovation. And one of the things that became really apparent from a lot of clinicians who are in the room is that there is concern that innovation is, and especially AI and generative AI, is a lot about replacing workforce.
Yeah.
And I can totally see that. I also know from all of the work that we do and the work we do with our alliance partners that, you know, 75% of the use cases that we're working on for generative AI are all about helping the clinical workforce. They're all about answering some of the big bugbears that clinicians complain about all the time, like clinical admin being the biggest one, you know, easy communications and sharing and tools, you know, being another. So none of this is about, like, can we have less people working in healthcare? We have a healthcare shortage workforce-wise in pretty much every country in the world. And we're in this horrible situation where everyone's just stealing workforce from each other in this horrible merry-go-round, which is helping nobody. So I don't think the issue is that we want to have fewer people working in healthcare. Every healthcare trend is demand up, need for workforce up in an unsustainable way. The game here is more, how can we use technology to make healthcare more standardized, reduce variability, increase quality, and most importantly, increase the quality of the experience that the clinical workforce is having. Because right now people say, I'm spending between 30 and 50% of my time doing clinical admin. I'm not patient facing, doing things I don't enjoy. And, you know, I get CVs every day from doctors who want to leave the NHS, and it breaks my heart because, you know, they've spent years training and we need them there, and they don't want to work there for, you know, a lot of these reasons. And these are things that can be fixed.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Sarah, can you give us some insight into the relationship and how exactly Deloitte works with the NHS? So, for example, for our listeners, a lot of the listeners will be thinking they've seen Deloitte in their hospitals. Usually it's to help budget cuts or to show a presentation and say, this is the strategy going forward. But you're talking about innovation and moving healthcare forwards. How does that actually happen at ground level? Because not all clinicians get to see where the Deloitte people are coming in.
That's true. And I should probably just take a step back as well and just describe a little bit more broadly the scope of services, because every project you do is not about innovation by a long shot, although it's really interesting to talk about. So, you know, Deloitte provides, it's a really broad-based professional services firm. So we have a real estate team that provides real estate advice to NHS trusts. We have a tax team that provides tax advice. We have a statutory audit practice. We are the external auditors of some NHS hospitals. We also do internal audit. And then we do a lot of advisory services. Our advisory services really run the gamut. You know, we do leadership and governance advisory. We do policy and strategy advisory. Mm-hmm. We do a lot of operational improvement at trust and ICB level. And then we do a lot of digital technology change and implementation work. And wrapped in with that, you know, it's not standalone. You know, here's a box that we're going to unpack and plug in for you. It's, what does your care pathway look like right now? How would this work better? What's manual that you don't want to be? You know, how would technology improve the experience for patients and staff? So it's a holistic approach. And I always say to anyone who will listen, you wouldn't hire Deloitte just because you have a single issue question. Like, I have an accounting question about this line, you know, in my accounts. You would hire Deloitte because you have a big, knotty issue that requires several disciplines.
Yeah.
So if you're trying to implement an electronic patient record, we can help with that. because we have technology experts in all of the big EPR systems. We also have a very big clinical team that sits alongside of them and can do training of clinicians and change management and all the other things that are needed. It's sort of a, how would we solve a really complicated problem? That's the kind of thing that you would come to us for.
No, definitely. Off the back of that, I wanted to ask, what do you think fuels the narrative of AI is here to replace doctors? It always seems to be a thing that comes first to mind when we know there is some AI already in clinical practice to some degree. There are so many low hanging fruits in terms of kind of administrative burden, helping with rotas, etc. What is fueling the narrative AI is replacing doctors, and how do we change it? How do we change the story?
Well, I don't think it's a health specific story. I think that's part of the problem. So if you zoom out and just look at the generative AI or the AI narrative in general, just listening to another podcast. I love podcasts. Listening to another podcast where somebody, I forget who it was, a law professor in the US was interviewing former President Barack Obama, who also loves to talk about AI. And he was basically saying, we need a new message to tell our young people about what they should be training for, because so many of our jobs are going to be changed or replaced by AI. So if that's the narrative coming out of world leaders, like, of course, it's going to trickle down to our sector and to other sectors as well. And I jokingly tell my children, like, I think we should just train you guys to be plumbers. I think that's the best thing that you could be doing.
Yeah.
And I have this disagree with my husband. He's always like, our kids should be coders. And I'm like, oh, I don't think so. I just got ChatGPT to code a whole new little, you know, I don't know how to code. I had someone else check it, obviously.
Yeah.
You know, but so I think the point is the narrative is changing for everybody in every industry. And I think every industry has this fear, rightly so. I know writers and journalists have this fear. Authors are having their content, you know, scraped and fed into these large language models. Yeah. There's all kinds of issues that are coming up that affect, you know, every single industry. But doesn't, and I'm not evading your question, it doesn't take away the need for us to answer this question for healthcare because it's hugely relevant. And we definitely want people to be attracted to train as doctors and nurses and to come and work in healthcare. We still need that. But I do think there is a big education question here, because education does tend to be a field which is a little slower to innovate than some other fields.
Yeah.
In an ideal world, you know, all kinds of clinical education would be A, compartmentalized so that you can do it in chunks, get practical experience, come back, do more, specialize as you figure out what you like. And also as innovation takes hold and the nature of what you're going to be doing changes so that you can stay current more easily. And I think that kind of modular training and, like, I don't know, meandering river kind of career instead of straight line needs to be considered from not early education, but, you know, from secondary school and certainly from university years. I think that would really help. Because you don't want to think like, oh, I'm going to commit to being a radiologist and that field is just going to get wiped out. And then I've got to go back and start from square one. Like, that's not a great way to be thinking about things.
That's very interesting. So slightly more on topic, I'm sure you saw the kind of the £300 million deal with Palantir in terms of kind of this new federated data platform. The two questions I have is, what are your thoughts on that? Do we think this is the start of interoperability, data sharing? And secondly, how important is it to have a platform or have open conversation between the industry and healthcare? Because, you know, a lot of clinicians or people on the floor, they don't like private companies. They think they're profit driven. They don't like when they see Deloitte and, you know, they read this £300 million deal and, you know, they're not increasing the salary of junior doctors. So keen to hear thoughts around that. And what does that mean moving forward into the future?
Yeah, sure. I might take your questions backwards if that's okay.
That's fine.
So the last thing you asked, the first thing I'll answer is about, you know, the thoughts about private companies and the interaction with the NHS and then monies that private companies get versus money that flows directly to, say, clinical salaries, like you mentioned. And I think, frankly, that this is a really unhelpful narrative in general, not commenting on that specific contract, but just in general, because the NHS, like all health systems, even publicly funded and provided health systems, have a private sector supply chain that feeds them in some way or others or other. People argue the toss whether GPs, who are seen as the core and the front line of the NHS, are private because they're entrepreneurs who are just paid by the NHS, but they're small business people. It doesn't matter how you classify them.
Yeah.
But you can definitely say that absolutely, you know, every drapes and gowns provider, you know, every clinical consumables provider, all of the things that prop up the NHS are private companies, you know? Mm. So there will always be private companies that you need to run a healthcare system, even a publicly funded and provided healthcare system. And I would argue that there are things that the NHS is great at that they should do themselves. And there are things that the NHS shouldn't in-house because either they have to do it once or because there are providers that already are really good at doing it and can do it at a lower cost than they could do it themselves. And those are the things that the NHS should pay for externally. Mm. I don't think it's possible to have a totally publicly, you know, funded system with no private anything touching it.
Yeah,
I totally get the point about, you know, there shouldn't be massive profiteering and it's the public sector. And that is all, you know, important and needs to be handled sensitively. That, I think, is the more nuanced argument that gets lost in a lot of the press that I read, I would say.
Yeah.
In terms of the federated data platform, I think the concept is incredibly important.
Yeah.
Both for research, for safety of patient care, you know, to have true national interoperable data that can be used for management of the system, management of capacity, future planning, population health, research. I mean, these are things which should be table stakes. And I wish that they had been implemented years ago. And I know why they haven't. And I know the history of our health service in this country and some of the other, you know, programs that have been taken on. But I think the concept is hugely important. And if you look at, you know, say my birth country, the US, you know, what happened with the Affordable Care Act is basically, you know, health systems couldn't get paid unless they made their records electronic. They couldn't transfer patients around between health systems unless they had an HIE, a health information exchange. Mm. So it was expensive, but it forced digitization and it forced data sharing. Mm. And that is, in the end, for the betterment of patients. You know, you don't want, I live in West London. You don't want to go visit your friend in Manchester, fall down, break your leg, have some ambulance pick you up, not know that you're a hemophiliac. It'd probably be pretty obvious, but, you know, not know your underlying health conditions and like do something that could harm you. I think a lot of patients assume that amongst medical professionals, that sort of information is shared. And frankly, unless you live in parts of London, Manchester, Yorkshire, it's not. And that's wrong. And that's just not safe.
I agree with your both points. The fact that the concept is super important and it should have been in existence already. What I didn't realize after you said it till now is when we have a publicly funded NHS healthcare system, we forget the fact that it is still propped up by private companies and a multitude of players, not just publicly funded bodies, which is very interesting.
I just wanted to pick that point of industry, private players and the healthcare system. So myself and Abdul, when we're envisioning a future for the healthcare system, we like to talk about coming to the table, and we think players all need to come to the table. And we're sort of trying to get a discourse going, right, between also clinicians, people on the ground also saying, you know what, maybe they're not the big bad werewolf. I just want to ask you, what are your thoughts and ideas on how do we get that discourse going between all the players to come to a table and actually discuss the benefits, the drawbacks, and just put their points forward rather than sitting in siloed corners and saying, no, they must be the bad guys. No, they're just money hungry. No, they don't really care about providing good patient care. It's just saving money. How do we get, because everyone's pointing fingers in different directions, right? How do we get us all to come to the table?
I mean, it would have to be a very big table.
Yeah.
I think maybe that's part of the problem. You know, the NHS is so big. I often have this question, like, what does the NHS think of us? What do they know about us? They just think like, oh, Deloitte, the accountants. Do they know that, you know, we partner, you know, with GP practices and work on software as a medical device and do all these different things? Like, probably not, right? So I think what you know is your sphere. It's what's around you. And for everybody in their own, you know, little bit of the NHS, that will be slightly different. Mm. I know that when we do surveys of our clients, they know us really well. And the things they say about us really ring true. And then when we survey organizations in the NHS that aren't our clients, they say things. And I'm like, where did they hear that from? You know, and it's just about what you know.
Definitely. Yeah, no, absolutely.
But I'd like to invite it to a very large table when you assemble it. That would be great.
Yeah. You mentioned earlier, you're getting a bunch of CVs of doctors looking to leave the profession. And a lot of our listeners are actively looking for kind of alternative careers. What advice would you give to them to successfully, you know, get into a company that's, you know, like Deloitte, get into a consulting role and what are some of the skills you need to have to be a good consultant and be able to kind of progress through the ranks?
Sure. I mean, step one, I would just say, like, before leaving the NHS, make a list of the things that are making you unhappy and see if there's a way that you can resolve 4 out of 5. And if you'd be happy with 4 out of 5, because I just think the most important thing is that we improve the NHS, and that has to happen from within. So if everyone decides they're unhappy and leaves, we don't fix the NHS. We make it worse by weakening it because everyone's left, and we don't fix the problems that were bugging us in the first place. So I also think some stuff is really tricky, like pay, right?
Yeah.
Inflation's been crazy. Everything's really expensive now. A big pay settlement for the NHS costs the government a lot because the NHS is so big. And you saw what happened yesterday. You know, consultants get a settlement. The nurses are like, well, what about us? I get it, right? Fair enough. And then the cycle continues. It's really tricky, that stuff. So some stuff is really hard like that. And I'm glad that's in the hands of politicians and not me. Some stuff we can totally do. Like, for example, during COVID, we all went to virtual working. Deloitte had a lot of offices around the UK, and we closed a bunch of them. And then we had a bunch of, like, lockers and sofas, and we put them all in storage, and we were paying for the storage. And they were like, well, we don't need this stuff because we're not reopening these offices. So I didn't actually know about this, but some of our people who run our offices have family that work in the NHS, like most people do, because everyone has, you know, friends and family that work in the NHS. And they said, hey, we have all these lockers. Do you need lockers? And they're like, yeah, totally. And they were like, well, we're paying for storage space. We'd like to stop paying for storage space. Yeah. Can you take these lockers off our hands? And they were like, yeah. Then we got the nicest letters from people being like, oh my God, it's so awesome to have a place to put my stuff.
Yeah.
Like, we can totally, some of these problems are not expensive. You know, we can totally solve some of this stuff. It's actually, I'm not saying that lockers is going to solve all the NHS's problems, but I just think if we break it down into bite-sized pieces, we can slowly eat the elephant. That wasn't your question. Your question was about getting a job in consulting. I talked about staying in the NHS. Consulting's not the only place, though. So I think, you know, clinical and managerial skills from the NHS are incredibly useful in a wide variety of fields. Obviously, you have all of the spaces around life sciences, medtech, biotech, pharma, where, you know, live knowledge of working in the health service in a clinical or non-clinical capacity is hugely relevant. You know, if you like human biology and the science side of things, this can be a great place to go. If you have a bigger risk appetite, there's an absolutely immense world of health tech startups doing the coolest stuff, you know. And if you're okay, if you don't have a big mortgage and lots of kids, and you're okay to take some risk and some equity that may or may not come good someday, like, that can be an amazing ride, and you'll learn tons and you'll get to do all kinds of roles that you're probably not fully qualified for, but you'll learn really fast. And I think that is another, you know, really exciting space. And I think that these are the companies that will, you know, my dad tells the story sometimes about how when Henry Ford invented the first car, everybody was worried about horse manure because all the city streets were clogged with horse manure. And that was, like, the biggest problem of the day, like, horse manure everywhere. And then, like, gone, you know, problem solved, new problems, enter fossil fuels, but solved. So I do think that there are innovations like that that literally probably exist in embryonic stage today, that if we do this podcast in 5 years, like, can you imagine that we didn't have, like, Zigitaboo 5 years ago, you know? And we'll be having that kind of conversation. I do think that big, and I'm a very hopeful person, but I do think that big stuff like that is coming down the track, and people with NHS experience can absolutely be a part of bringing those to market. Some of my most successful colleagues and friends around the health space are people that have had, very unlike me, careers in chapters where they were an NHS manager. They went and worked for maybe a big kind of healthcare management company or a GPO in the US. Then they did a startup. Then they went to work for venture partners who were investing in startups. And each step of their journey, you know, was very accretive to their overall knowledge and to the value they could bring, and got them to their next step. So I think there's lots and lots of options for people with NHS experience, including consulting. We have lots of clinicians. They are amazing. And we couldn't do our job without them.
Thank you. And thank you for kind of highlighting the other opportunities and the benefits that lie there. One of the questions I wanted to ask is, clearly, to progress in your career as you have, you need to be a good leader. How does one become a good leader? What is important? And how do you kind of have that healthy culture with the people that you work with, the people that work underneath you? Some advice on that would be, you know, quite interesting to hear.
That's probably a question for my team, not me.
How is Sarah as a boss?
I guess, but here are some things that I think about. One, say thank you a lot, because it doesn't cost you anything and you mean it, but you forget to say it and it means so much to other people. Two, be humble and show fallibility. When you're wrong, say, I got that one wrong. I'm sorry about that. And here's what we're going to do differently. Like, be human, you know, because I think modeling that behavior lets other people do the same. And the thing I always say to my teams is, when we start off, before I know you well enough, just over communicate. Because I want to know more rather than less. I don't want you to see that there's a mistake in the model somewhere and then hide it and try to fix it yourself. And then like try to fluff it up with the client and say, oh, it was always that number. Like, I want everything out on the table. So I think, you know, showing fallibility is really important to enable that kind of culture.
No,
that's the other thing is to empower people and just let them go where they want to go and be who they want to be, even if that means that you're taking a little bit more risk than you might like, or doing a little bit less yourself than you might like, stepping back more than you might like. Always hire people that are better and smarter than you. Like, I think, you know, that's the best thing. And then your team just gets bigger and better and more broad, and you can do more, and it's got to be bigger than the sum of the parts. So a lot of that comes down to ego. Like, don't let your ego, your personal id, you know, get in the way of the greatness of the whole.
That's really good advice, and I can tell you're a good leader. I'm tempted to leave my job and come work for you, Sarah.
This is definitely, to be clear, everybody listening, this is not a recruiting pitch for NHS doctors. Stay in your jobs.
One of the things, you know, our listeners were key to hear is we see all of these amazing job titles and job roles. We know it's not all kind of roses and sunshine. What are some of the difficulties you've faced in your career? You know, what are some of the setbacks and how have you overcome them?
So much we could talk about here.
Let's pick one.
I mean, at the end, work is work, right? Like, days are long, work is hard, things don't go your way, your perfect plans don't come to fruition. I'll never forget, I was doing a project once and it was just taking a lot longer than it should have done. People weren't agreeing on what the right answer was. And I had booked to take my mom for Mother's Day on a trip to New York City. And I had booked us a hotel and I got us tickets to a show and I booked a restaurant.
Oh, wow.
And in the end, I had to work the whole weekend and we had to cancel the trip and I had to eat all the money I had spent on all this stuff. And she was heartbroken and I was heartbroken. And like, there's a million little disappointments like that along the way, I guess. And it's just one of those things where, like, I still remember that with a little pang, like, but I knew that I just had to make that choice and that my mom would understand. And, you know, we had to, you know, do the work to get the project over the line. So yeah, it's definitely, as you say, Abdul, it's not all sunshine, but like the glory is great. Like, I have a team that just took Epic Live at Guy's and St. Tommy's in Kings, and it was the single biggest go live of Epic anywhere in the world. And I'm so proud of them. And I think it's just amazing. So, you know, when I see their videos at 4 a.m. being like, yay, it makes me so happy. So there's joy too. It's not all heartbreak stories.
That's incredible. And that's like really doing things at scale and having real genuine impact. We trained at Guy's and St. Thomas's, so it's close to our heart. But no, Sarah, what would you like to see in the next 5 years? This is the last and final questions. We're going to stop after this. But, you know, where do you see yourself in the next 5 years? I kind of probably know the answer to that. And what would you like to see more from the workforce, all our listeners that are consultants, clinicians, NHS managers? You know, what would you like to say to them?
Yeah, sure. I'm going to go backwards again, Abdul.
For sure.
So in terms of, you know, the workforce in the NHS, I would say the change begins and ends with you, especially with the clinical workforce. Nothing's ever going to get implemented without the blessing of clinicians in terms of new tech, in terms of innovation, in terms of AI, in terms of anything. So be the change you want to see. Bring ideas to the table. If you don't like something, say no, but say why and say what would be better and be a constructive part of that process. Because I really think that clinicians are both, you know, the path to the future success of the NHS and the reason why it may not be successful. So it's like really all in your hands is what I would say.
Yeah.
And if I look at my most successful projects, I'm going to call out the medical director up at NHS Lothian. You know, it was the clinicians who championed an awesome idea and implemented something new and innovative that, you know, helped out them and their teams and really broke ground. It's always the clinicians. The first part of your question in terms of the next 5 years, I mean, from a more personal perspective, I've just taken on this global healthcare role for Deloitte. been in the role for less than a year, and I've just been getting to grips with what's happening around the world, really trying to meet the teams around the world, trying to learn about the health systems around the world. And I just think there's a huge opportunity to do more, back to your big table idea, Ams, to do more convening, more getting together. This is something that costs us nothing. And I think, you know, getting a director of transformation, you know, from Taiwan or Saudi Arabia or Germany together with colleagues from the NHS and having a chat, which I think to a certain extent is happening in some fields, especially on the science side of things. I think scientists are really well connected in the world. I don't feel like from a healthcare systems perspective, we're as well connected as we could be. And I think some of just that, having some friendly chats, again, virtually, we don't have to fly around the world. We should be, you know, more net zero about it.
Yeah.
Can really help. Because I think a lot of times within the NHS, there is a competition, which can be healthy, but which can also be unhealthy. And people don't want to do what the neighbor down the road's doing for whatever reason. Mm-hmm. But I am hopeful that they may be less averse to doing what someone in another country is doing. And that's something that I really hope to kind of up the ante on in the next few years.
No, that's incredible.
Amazing.
Sarah, thank you so much for taking the time out. It's always interesting to kind of hear your personal story. You know, I'm sure lots of people have been affected by some of the stuff you've initiated, the projects you've delivered, without knowing who you are. So it's nice to kind of put a name to the face and, you know, hear who you are. So absolute pleasure to have, you know, had you on the show today, Sarah. Thank you so much.
I really enjoyed it. And I just want to say, when you guys reached out, I listened to another episode and I just thought it was such a great interview. And it was like, just really honest and long, but like raw. And I thought that was a wonderful way to approach this. I think I'm sure you are building a lot of trust with your listeners. And so listening to your other work is what attracted me to this. And I do love a podcast. So thanks for having me.
No, thank you so much.
Thank you so much.